Well, hello everybody and welcome to Fire and Wire. This time we're going beyond the podcast in here, the university's fantastic Botanic Garden and Arboretum. And I'm delighted to be here with Dr. Chris Thorogood, who is the Deputy Director, and he's also Head of Science at this incredible garden.
We're looking at Britain's oldest botanic garden. So founded in 1621, right. Was built up by, 4,000 wagon loads of muck and dung by the university scavenger. So the plants grow very well,
right.
Still.
Good, good.
And it was particularly to grow medicinal plants, to teach you the university's medical students about how plants were used in herbal medicine.
Because somebody who's still teaching the medical students about pain and reef and different ways that we can do that, I'm all ears to hear more about it.
Let's go see some plants.
Yeah, wonderful.
So we're standing here in the taxonomic beds, and we have a collection of some 5,000 or so different types of plant from all around the world. And that's what's so wonderful about a university botanic garden. And this collection of plants serves a vital role in research. And so we have researchers sort of using these taxonomic beds as a living DNA library, if you will, of plants, and also students. And we teach in the botanic garden as well.
So the students actually come down.
They do.
Lectures,
they
right.
do. And so we run practicals here in the botanic garden with our biology students who can actually sort of walk through the flowering plant family tree and so learn through that experience.
God, how extraordinary. What a treat.
It's truly immersive.
Oh, well, you can't beat that immersive sort of learning experience. Yeah. Now, can you give us just sort of a quick summary and simple explanation of what you mean by taxonomic? Because obviously it's a key part of the garden.
Originally, these beds were organised by how the plants appeared. So plants that looked like one another were classified together. But actually, over the last few decades, scientists have sequenced the DNA of these plants. And so we now know more than ever before about how those plants are related. And so the team here has reorganized the beds according to their genetic relatedness. And so you can walk through the DNA sort of family tree, if you will, of flowering plants, and you can see how plants are related to one another.
Fantastic.
I mean, that's the wonderful thing about a botanic garden.
And of course that brings in the evolution then of the plants
exactly.
and where they split on
that's
that.
It.
Fantastic. Well, look, show me some more.
Please follow me.
Lovely to see so many people around as well.
Yes, but actually not too busy because during the summer holiday is which is lovely for us and commercial income, but it's quite gentle on a day like today. So Irene, we should just stop here so I can show you our oldest living specimen.
Oh, wow, a yew tree.
It's an English yew, Taxus baccata.
Right.
And it was planted in 1645.
Goodness.
By a man called Jacob Bobart the Elder, who was the Botanic Garden's first keeper. And so he planted up the garden in the 1640s, and he would have planted this yew tree along with several others probably along this main path. And it may have been clipped actually as part of a topiary display, and perhaps that's one of the reasons it's a little smaller than you might expect for a tree of this age.
Right.
And we also lost some of it in Storm Ciara, but yew trees are very easily regenerated, and so it's actually recovered quite well.
Extraordinary, 1645, I mean, it's just jaw-dropping. Yes. Trees are my sort of favourite.
I
absolutely love them. I just love the majesty of them and the fact that they live for hundreds of years, particularly this particular type.
Exactly.
And just the history they've seen.
Exactly. Sort of this garden as it's changed through sort of the conditions along with Oxford alongside it and the things that it's seen
it's
over the course of several centuries.
The secrets
and, exactly. No, there's a certain sort of resonance, a whisper of time in the botanic garden when you walk among trees like these. And we hope it will see several hundred years still.
Well, let's hope.
And probably time enough for us to walk to the next area, so follow me.
Great. Okay, so we're in a very different bit of the garden, Chris, now. So
it's got quite a different look and feel, hasn't it?
Yeah,
so this
it really
is the
does.
Lower garden, Irene. So we were in the walled physic garden, as was, the historic garden, and we've entered the lower garden. So it's a lot less formal. And we're standing at the moment in our rock garden, which has a Mediterranean theme.
It really does.
And I love this. It does, It's really evocative of the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly what we wanted to achieve, to give people that experience to walk through a garrigue or a maquis, as we call it, vegetation type. Those lovely oils that volatilise from the plants.
Certainly the smells, absolutely. I just feel like I'm in the Mediterranean on a little mini break. Not in the middle of city centre on the high street.
Exactly.
How fantastic. Great. And there's something special you want to show me as well, as
there
I understand it. Yeah, all right, I'm bracing myself for this. Come on.
So am I. No risk assessment, I mean.
All right,
I can't afford to.
I'll avert my eyes.
Yeah, exactly. we had Raymond Blanc here and he started eating. I was like, Raymond, no. So let me introduce to you the squirting cucumber.
You're kidding.
So this is Ekbaliums. This is actually a relative of the cucumber that we're familiar with, but this is not an edible one.
Okay.
And it's actually explosive. So this is the little missile waiting to explode.
Right.
And so this capsule has a build-up internally of tergopressure, so a water build-up inside the capsule. And what this does is it fires the seeds out in a jet that's quite explosive and quite disturbing. So I'm going to try and direct it away from us.
Okay.
And are we ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
Let's
ready?
Go for it.
Oh, gee. Wow. Ooh, that was spectacular. Why does it do it?
Yeah, do you know, that's one of the questions we're actually seeking to understand, Irene. So we've done all sorts of things with these squirting cucumbers, from CT scanning them to mathematically modelling them to answer those questions. How and why are these plants the way they are?
How with the mathematician? Where's the maths?
If this cucumber fires its seeds over the course of, let's say, 9 metres, and if those seeds grow and certain numbers survive, what would that look like in future generations? Yeah. And then we can start to understand, well, what might be the selective advantage in terms of evolution for these fruits exploding their seeds in a sort of linear transect, if you like, of several metres? And it might be that that's to get the future generations of plants away from the parent plant to reduce competition, for example.
Of course, so, it makes such sense now you explain like that. Okay, I've got to have a go. Can I?
Please do, to give it a gentle touch and it should...
Go, guy. Oh, wow, I barely touched it.
Yeah, I know.
How spectacular.
It's very sensitive.
Wow. And so it'll just spontaneously do that?
Yeah, it does.
At some point when it's ready.
It will do it of its own accord when it reaches a sort of a certain threshold.
Yep.
But otherwise, if you touch it, then it does it early. So, you know.
It was impressive. Yeah. Okay, let's get somewhere safe.
Yeah. Follow me.
Great. Thanks, Chris. That was terrific.
That's a good one, wasn't it?
That was a good one. Yeah, I got a break. So, Chris, you brought me to this bit now.
Yes.
I can hear some kids playing rugby in the background there, which is lovely to hear. We've got birds squawking and twittering away. I'm looking at probably Oxford's most spectacular border.
Yeah.
Tell me why you wanted to show me this. And...
Happy to you say that, Irene. So we're still in the lower garden, and we're standing next to the herbaceous border. I love it because it just changes so much with the season. So if you come here in the spring, you'll see all the bulbs flowering. And then in September, it's just this sort of riot of colour and everything sort of jostling for space, jostling for position. And I think it's a real spectacle. And you know, we have 200,000 or so people come to the Botanic Garden Arboretum every year. They love seeing this border and walking past it. And I think more than that, more than people loving to see it, I think it's actually really an important part of Oxford's green estate, the Botanic Garden, and that people find sanctuary here. And it's an important part of people's mental health and well-being coming to green spaces like this.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think we saw that during the pandemic.
Yes.
People just really sought out, didn't they, getting into parks. Having, I think, an appreciation again of just the value.
They did, and we saw that, and we saw people actually had quite an emotional response when they came back to the Arboretum in particular, actually. Yeah. A really, really strong connection with the site.
Yeah. I know that you're doing some collaboration with some of my colleagues, as a neuroscientist things. So tell me a little bit more about the sort of programmes you're doing there.
Yeah, so we work closely with Professor John Geddes and his team on the flourishing theme of his biomedical research centre project, particularly seeking to understand, we talk about the benefits that green spaces and nature bring to mental health, brain health and well-being, but how do we understand what that looks like, what is a dose of green health, for example. And so we're very much looking forward to working with John and his colleagues to use these green spaces as sort of living laboratories for seeking to understand that. So that's a really exciting
piece of
work.
So get some sort of data, evidence.
Exactly.
And how we can then roll that out.
Evidence-based, quite. And then also linked to that, we're doing a lot of work engaging with new audiences and underrepresented groups at both our sites as well, so that as many people as possible can benefit from what green spaces like ours have to offer.
Fantastic. I mean, 200,000 visitors, you said, that's just heartwarming for me to hear, because as you know, I'm really passionate about our role in the local community and the national, and again, having this extraordinary privilege set of places that we've got, and we get the chance to look after and curate.
Indeed.
Available for more people to come and see, so it's just wonderful to
it's
hear
It's a privilege,
that.
Yeah.
Fantastic, wow. And we're seeing it at its best. You'd say September is
it's a little past its best.
Just a little, okay.
A little.
Okay, okay.
And it's been a difficult summer, but it's still looking fine.
Yeah, it's looking fabulous. No complaints from me. Great, so onwards we go.
Yes, follow me.
So So Chris, we're in the boiling glass houses.
No, sweltering.
It's like a sauna. I want to hear about your research. You told us about the amazing collaborations you're doing with psychiatry and with maths. But I know that you've got a very particular interest in your research area. So let's hear about your work and tell us why we're in here.
Thanks, Irene. Well, I work with botanists all over the world, but I'm going to tell you about a particular set of projects that I've been working on quite recently, broadly under the subject of biomimetics, which is how we can look at nature for solutions to problems in design and technology, for example.
Right.
And I'll start with a little story. So we have in front of us these botanical enigmas, as I think of them, these extraordinary floating platforms. So these are the world's largest floating leaves.
Yeah,
they belong
huge.
To the genus Victoria. And these are actually quite small. In the middle of the summer, they're even growing larger.
Right.
So it's a giant Amazonian water lily. And my physicist friends, I was showing them around this pond, and they said to me, oh, Chris, how and why do these leaves grow so large? And I said, oh, well, you know, leaves are for photosynthesis. So the larger the surface area, the better it serves the plant. But they said, well, you know, but not all leaves grow that large. And so I thought, well, this is curious. How and why do these leaves grow so large? And so we did a bit of research. And to our astonishment, no one had actually sought to answer that question. How and why do these water lilies grow so large? And so we set about to address that. And we did all sorts of experiments to look at the load-bearing capacity, the strength, the elasticity, and all sorts of other things. So we were prodding them, sinking them, pulverizing them, weighing them. And what we found is that the structure of this enormous leaf is what defines its strength
and ability
to grow so large.
Right.
And so you can see one that the team here flipped over.
Oh,
so you can see the underside.
Oh, I see. So that's the underside.
That's
right.
The underside.
Gosh, that's beautiful. Pretty robust, yeah.
And it has this extraordinary lattice of sort of intersecting girders, if you like. And then those are covered in a very thin sort of elastic sheet. And actually, what we found, again through mathematical modelling, is that for this size, the optimum is this structure. In other words, it's the minimum amount of stuff that you can formulate to cover the largest amount of surface area and still be strong enough to withstand any sort of perturbations or stresses in your environment.
Extraordinary.
And of course, there's a cost to growing such a large leaf, because
you
have to service your real estate, you know.
Yes,
it requires plumbing and maintenance. And so that's what we found. And so this is an economically very efficient structure. And why we think that's exciting is that that might be a source of inspiration for example, floating offshore solar farms.
Yeah,
so we're very
wonderful,
excited by that.
Yeah.
And then, as we're standing here, this is another.
This is pitcher plants. They're always actually fascinating.
Yeah.
So why are you into them?
I've always loved these plants ever since I was a kid, and so I feel so lucky to be able to actually work on them now here in Oxford. But we're interested in why, particularly, these slippery rims that insects tumble off and fall into this stomach, if you will.
Yeah.
How and why are they such different shapes and sizes, the different geometries? And so my clever colleagues have done all sorts of mathematical modelling to look at computational insects and how they behave on different parts of that structure.
Right.
And what we found in our recent research is that the different geometries of these peristomes, they're called, on the trap, have a profound impact on the size and the type of prey that these plants can attract.
Right.
And so when we think of, for example, Darwin's finches in the Galapagos Islands, and they have different beak shapes that are adapted to tapping into different sources of food, so with plants such as these, they have different shapes and sizes of trap. So if I can ask you to feel this surface, and you'll feel it's rough in one plane and smooth in another.
Oh, it's silky in
the
other. Oh, it's lovely.
So it's covered in these ridges that you can think of as energy railings, my physicist colleagues call them. And these actually direct insects into the trap in a way that's non-arbitrary. So they're slipping in a way that's very tightly controlled. They're sort of driven into the trap. And this also has an application in microfluidics and a form of technology called slippery liquid infused porous surface technology, SLIPS, which is used in all sorts of everyday objects.
Yep.
And so microfluidics are used in medical devices and also inkjet printers.
Yeah, of course.
And this can be informed by these wonderful adaptive surfaces in pitcher plants.
Well, of course, plants have had millions of years of evolution and to fine-tune exactly how they do things. So, you know, we often think that we know everything, but there's so much amazing stuff that we just need to keep learning from plants,
there's
don't we?
So much we can learn from nature.
Oh,
exactly.
Fantastic. Great. Now, I can't help but observe these glass houses look, you know, they look old and they look like they need a bit more TLC, or we need to just really radically improve the working conditions that you have here. So tell me about the ambition for that and how can we help?
Yeah, so that's our big priority here at the Botanic Garden, is to fundraise for new glasshouses. So just as you say, Irene, the infrastructure, beautiful though the plants are that are grown inside, the infrastructure itself is beyond its sort of use-by date, to be honest. Yeah. So the glasshouses were built in the early 1970s and they're not really in some places fit for purpose now. And so it's vital that to achieve this mission of inspiring people with the scientific wonder of plants and growing these wonderful things to support research and education, that we have the infrastructure to support that. So that's our priority here, is to actually build new glasshouses to enable us to do that. And I should add, add that it will reduce our carbon footprint by 92% if we have new glasshouses.
Well, because these are leaking. That alone. Because energy is just pouring out.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very important for us.
Okay, well, that's a great challenge. So, noted. So, Chris, we're getting to sort of what I call June o'clock time of the evening. I'm smelling juniper. I'm seeing these beautiful roses. Yeah. I know that you make something very special here with the botanicals. Tell me about it.
So we're sitting in the gin bed, actually, Irene.
And my favourite go-to place.
Yeah, exactly. So we actually have a partnership with Oxford Artisan Distillery, who harvest botanicals from the Botanic Garden to make physic gin. And the list of botanicals is actually inspired by that original list of plants that were grown here in the Botanic Garden in 1648. So it's a little bit like drinking history. So it's a very special gin. It's also our blockbuster product in the Botanic Garden shop as well. So it's
what does that say?
Commercial income, yeah, exactly.
About our visitors.
But you know, commercial income is important to the Botanic Garden. Yeah. And we also develop, for example, that we're sitting next to this lovely rose, which you just pointed out, which is Oxford Physic Rose, which was also developed by us in partnership with a rose breeder as well, and launched at the Chelsea Flower Show last year as well. And it's beautiful, isn't it?
And that was to celebrate our
400th anniversary.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's a beautiful rose. It's absolutely lovely. It looks pretty resilient too, understand it.
Yeah, it is.
Things that affect roses. So Chris, before I have then my gin and tonic this evening, you know, why should a university like Oxford have a botanic garden? Just tell us why it's so important to have places like this.
Yeah. Plants are actually the answer to many of the global challenges that we face. Plants are the food we eat, the clothes we wear, the medicines we take. And yet we live in an era when many people actually scarcely notice with plants or don't engage with them. So we as human beings, as animals, are very much attuned to other animals in our world. Less so plants, actually, and this is a phenomenon that social scientists have called metaphorically plant blindness. We're simply less attuned to seeing them in the environment around us. And that's worrying at a time when 2 in 5 of the world's plant species are now threatened with extinction. Gosh. So we need to care about plants. You know, they're fundamental to our existence. They're under threat. So it's never been more important. And our mission is to engage people with the scientific wonder of plants. That's what we're truly passionate about.
Well, you're doing a fantastic job of it. And again, the platform we have as, you know, one of the world's big universities to also champion and speak about the work that you're doing, be assured we'll do everything we can, and I will, to support it. So all I can say is thank you so much for spending this time. It's been a real treat for me to get out and have this afternoon. Wish you all the very best with the research and the teaching that you're doing. I can't wait to bring some of the medical students down to again show them some of the pain relieving medicines in the Physic Garden, and I say it's time for that gin and tonic.
Absolutely.